You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
35 years ago this week, another woman Prime Minister sent a task force halfway across the world to defend the freedom of another small group of British people against another Spanish-speaking country. And I'm absolutely certain that our current Prime Minister will show the same resolve in standing by the people of Gibraltar.
Former Conservative leader Lord Howard suggests the UK might go to war over the future of Gibraltar post-Brexit. My guests Tom Rivers and Martin Plaut will unpack this and the day's other top stories, including Donald Trump's ultimatum to China over North Korea's nuclear capability, how South Africa's Jacob Zuma's latest cabinet reshuffle might end up being a huge misstep, and how a university turned into a democracy battleground in Budapest. That's all to come on Midori House over the next 30 minutes with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, where my guests today are Tom Rivers and Martin Plaut. Tom Rivers is ABC News' London radio correspondent, and Martin Plaut is a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London. Welcome both to the studio. Now we start today's show with a look at Gibraltar. This British overseas territory has dominated the headlines over the weekend following the publication of draft Brexit negotiation guidelines by the EU, stating that any decisions affecting Gibraltar would have to be run past Spain. The guidelines prompted an unexpected response from the former Conservative leader, Lord Howard, saying that Theresa May would defend Gibraltar in the same way as Margaret Thatcher defended the Falklands, by going to war. Martin, is this a sensible response? It seemed, you know, slightly getting carried away. And I noticed that actually Spain's foreign minister, Alfonso Dastis, said that he was surprised by the tone, saying it seems someone is losing their cool. And it did seem just a bit daft, didn't it?
Oh, I think it's more than daft. I think it's barking. I mean, the idea that anybody's going to go to war over Gibraltar, I don't think we're anywhere near it. And Theresa May rapidly came back saying to journalists that she was into jaw, not war. And I think it's absolutely clear that they're not going down that road. I mean, unless there's some huge issue. I mean, you know, from time to time, the Spaniards do, you know, encroach on what Britain thinks are its territorial waters around Gibraltar. And there have been occasions when, you know, things got a little bit hairy and they close the border and make life unpleasant. But, you know, I find it hard to believe that it's going to happen.
Tom, watching the crumbling bits of empire as an American correspondent, is
right.
What do you make of this story?
You know, I thought it was an opportune moment for Spain to say, let's play the linkage game. And let's try to, if you want to play ball, then let's see what we can do. We've been knocking on the door of Gibraltar for decades and nothing has ever happened. So they're going to try to at least throw the card out there right now and see what happens. But you're right. It's for Michael Howard to come out at this early stage of the game swinging seems a little bit misplaced. This is going to be a hell of a two-year marathon if you're lucky. To come out at this sprinting at this stage is a little bit but premature.
Tom, when you look at British politics at the moment, there's so many that we had a story today that, you know, that we might be able to go back to one of the commenters in one of the papers were saying we can go back to using pounds and ounces, we can go back to good old Fahrenheit. You know, other people are getting all excited about bringing back a blue passport rather than a red passport.
Yeah.
You know, as a piece of contemporary, you know, legislation, we're trying to reposition the country as a modern, forward-looking mm-hmm. place, and, you know, supposedly be free of certain shackles that some people felt were put on the country. It all sounds like some horrible attempt to kind of drag us back to 1950, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, that's the big question. Do you want this to become Little Britain, or do you want to be a modern, independent, important country on the world stage? And cutting important modern deals and being 21st century, or do you want to be 20th century or 19th century? The choice is there. and we'll see how it plays out.
Martin, when we look at Gibraltar, what's also interesting is the Gibraltarians voted overwhelmingly to remain within the European Union. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to be part of this Brexit Britain. They are going to be part of it. But now they seem to be a bit kind of like confused about their identity. They don't want to be part of the EU, but they don't really want to leave with Britain. You know, for many British people, it is because it's a vestige of empire. But isn't it about time you had a bit of a sensible conversation with the Spanish about, okay, it kind of is part of your country. How do we find a situation where everybody's a little bit happier and we can move away from this kind of holding onto a ridiculous rock?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. You clearly have not read the Treaty of Utrecht of 1714 and the implications of the War of Spanish Succession. I mean, you know, just because it's over 300 years old doesn't mean it's not an absolutely integral part of Britain. I don't know what you're talking about. And, you know, really, there is nothing to worry about. The key indicator are the apes. The Gibraltar apes, the macaque, who are the only free-running monkeys in the whole of Europe, are up at 230. Last time we worried about them was during the Second World War. There were only seven left.
Really?
And the theory is that when the apes go, the British will go too. And Churchill actually imported them from Algiers to make sure that there were enough apes. So there are plenty of apes. Everything is okay.
Well, they steal things, don't they, off people? I think they're not a very good sign of Britishness.
Ah, they're very popular. Very popular.
They've always got
very
their,
good. They're on the currency.
They've always got their hands in people's pockets. Before we move on, tell me, what do you make of this, you know, the idea of bringing back the blue passport and, you know, all these debates that are springing up around it? It feels a very strange thing to be worrying about when there are so many more important issues on the plate. There's a feeling you get that many people do want to go back to an identity that we had, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, that they feel something missing in their lives at the moment.
I think you've hit on a very important point, because actually one of the reasons why older people voted in droves for Brexit was because, not because it was they were coming to the edge and this was something new, but because they were returning to a golden past that they all remembered. They remembered when Britain wasn't part of the EU. And so actually there was a key point that they could go back to their youth, and when everything was wonderful. One's youth is always wonderful. So, you know, there is that sense that of going back. But there's one other point. You know, I used to be in industrial relations. I advised Mobil Oil on industrial relations many, many, many years ago. And we always used to have massive negotiations about all sorts of things, highly complex. Nobody ever gave a damn about them. But you could always have a fight about the bicycle shed, because everybody understood it. It's these symbolic issues that are the ones you have a fight about.
Okay, well, luckily Britain doesn't have a bicycle shed perched on Gibraltar.
We don't have much of a navy either.
We're going to turn the focus now to the US. In an interview with the Financial Times, Donald Trump has issued China with an ultimatum. If it fails to put pressure on North Korea to disable its nuclear program, then the US is prepared to take action against Pyongyang on its own. Now, Tom, here, perhaps we do have a more potential real threat of war. Do we feel this again is bluster, though, or an attempt to move the Chinese, you know, into action? Or do you think that Mr. Trump actually thinks he could attack North Korea?
I think it's 100% bluster, but many people of my colleagues in America will say he's used bluster in the campaign and he's trying to follow through in terms of trying to, not very successfully yet, to trying to get some legislation through. But yes, you look back at how many years of six-party talks have gone absolutely nowhere. There have been, you know, every time there's talk of, oh, we're going to put more sanctions on, and the sanctions, it's the most isolated country on the planet. How much pressure has Beijing put on North Korea? And Trump thinks he has the Trump card, and that he says, I think that trade is the real incentive to use that as a stick against China to play ball. But at this stage of the game, you can't say, you know, these are it's a country that's been entrenched now and built their tunnels since 53, and the targets aren't out there. You can't unilaterally do this. So it in my view, it's nothing but bluster.
Martin, here's an issue. I actually have some sympathy with Donald Trump, but I think that when you look at U.S. policy over the recent decades, there have been attempts to woo the North Koreans with grain, with aid, with money. There's been attempts to stand up to them, to use propaganda, to do anything to try and move their position. But unless the Chinese come on board and agree that something needs to change, nothing's going to happen. And he's right, in a way, Donald Trump, isn't he, that something has to change, because otherwise we are going to end up in a situation where you have a slightly crazy leader who's very likely to be putting his finger on a button.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, the Donald said that the Kim could come and have a hamburger with him and that all would be well. I mean, I think that was obviously not a serious suggestion, but that's what Mr. Trump said during the election mm-hmm. campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not going to, I don't see that working. But I mean, there are really only, as far as I can see, two options. You either get the Chinese on board, you increase pressure, diplomatic pressure, or frankly, you go for the military option. And, you know, the problem is that the you know, as has been said, the North Koreans have been developing nuclear missiles. They've had two tests. They have had firings of missiles. They're getting closer to Japan. They will soon be able to hit the United States itself. You know, at what point are you going to say we cannot allow this? And at that point, do you, I mean, at when do you actually press the button and say that we're going to now use blanket cruise missiles and other, you know, the stealth bombers to flatten the areas in which these missiles are going to be held? But of course, everyone knows what will happen next is that that the North Koreans will go for the South Koreans.
Exactly.
And the death toll will be astronomical,
exactly.
Which is why nobody's ever gone down that road. But there are really no further options, and somebody's going to have to take a decision at some stage.
Before I bring Tomac in, but do you think that he has any leverage with President Xi then? Do you think he can force him to be a little bit more robust in his action? Because the Chinese have begun to take some action in recent years, and you know they have upheld many of the sanctions, but it doesn't seem to be enough to kind of hit home.
I doubt whether even if the Chinese, look, I am not a specialist on the area, but it seems unlikely to me if the Chinese exercised all their leverage, I can't see the North Koreans giving in.
Tom, when you look at the story with China, we had in the run-up to the election, you know, a lot of kind of anger aimed at the Chinese. They were stealing jobs. They mm-hmm. were, you know, they were probably some of the bad dudes out there. Now we get closer, you know, into what real government is right. like, and Jared Kushner has been doing nicey-nicey with the Chinese, mm-hmm. trying to make friends. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Donald Trump actually sees an opportunity here after all of his bluster to bring the Chinese on side in a way?
You know, it's going to be, they've got 2 days of talks, I think, in Florida, Thursday and Friday this week. So let's kind of scratch our heads after that and see what comes out of it. One thing you got to give the Donald is he is the deal maker. So we'll see if he can actually do something. As you've said, Martin, no one else has been able to do for many years. And maybe he can pull a rabbit out of the hat, because maybe he can get one-on-one talks going, as you say. Try that. What if you fail? So what? You know, multi-party talks don't work, haven't worked. Why should they work in the future?
But Tom, there's one thing just worries me, in a sense, is that somebody like Trump is, you know, has a big failure on his hands already, at least one, maybe more.
Well, more, yeah.
And at what point is he going to say, my credibility is slipping away, I am the deal maker, mm-hmm. I'm beginning to be tarnished with failure, and then he goes for the big one. And at what point will he do that?
I hope that's not the case here, because you and I exactly are going to be getting on the next plane for whatever remains of Seoul, because that's going to be the chapter that we don't want to go down.
And you refer to him as the deal maker, and as Martin says, you know, first of all, on the issue of the so-called Muslim ban, mm-hmm. that has not been a success. Exactly. On the repeal of Obamacare, right. that has not been a success. He doesn't have a big win under his belt yet. And although he's going to revisit some of these issues, he mm-hmm. says he's going to look at taxation. You know, for you, when you look at him, do you still see him as a successful business person who has the potential to deliver that deal? Because that's the interesting thing about this FT interview today. Actually, Lionel Barber, I heard being interviewed this morning, who's the editor of the FT, saying that actually he thought there was more to Donald Trump than we'd perhaps given him credit for. And he felt there was still some potential for him to deliver.
I think he's got time, at least at this stage of the game, on his side. So Andrew, he can go back and say, let's revisit it. He may jettison his ideas on immigration, but he will go back and try to pound the drum on Obamacare again. So he's not at that point where he has to go for a desperation shot. So I think he's got a long run to go. He's only used up, what, 2.5 months of the clock so far. So I think he's got some time to go.
But as he kind of finds allies, do you think he would be able to bring on the right of the Republican Party, who seemed to have moved against him on many issues, didn't support him over Obamacare? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that you see his more natural allies now actually with some Democrats who might be willing to do deals if they feel it looks after their constituents?
Well, it's not the clean party kind of thing with him. Never has been on issues. There's little bits and pieces of both parties that will agree and disagree. But I think the Republicans will eventually fall in line on some issues, and the clock will be ticking for Congress, who gets reelected every 2 years. And they know that they have to play ball and they have to get some results if they want to be coming back for what's the last 2 years of his first term.
Well, Tom Rivers and Martin Powell, thank you very much for now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and we're going to take a short break now. After this, we're going to move on to South Africa.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Kristin Scott Thomas.
We actors give the director and the editor and everyone else involved in the film and the making of the film sort of raw material to do their job with.
The Academy Award nominated actress sits down with Robert Bound to discuss the creation of a character, why she managed to resist Hollywood directing her first film, and the unique demands of being an actress.
I was involved in this extraordinary film, which is having an extraordinary success, but then I had to keep talking about how wonderful and how cold it was in the desert at night and how wonderful it was to be working with Ralph Fiennes, and you know, and it just got too much.
The Big Interview with Kristin Scott Thomas. Download it now at monocle.com.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Istanbul, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are my guests, Tom Rivers and Martin Plaut. Now, last week, South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, sacked his finance minister and made 10 new cabinet member appointments in a dramatic late-night reshuffle. The ousted finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, was removed after a lengthy battle with Zuma over government spending. The move sent the rand into downfall and prompted the South African Communist Party, which governs the country in an alliance with the ANC, to urge Zuma to quit. Martin, explain the background to all this for us.
We should actually say one thing that's happened in the last about hour and a half, which is that Standard & Poor's has now downgraded South Africa to junk bond status, which means every South African will now be poorer. It'll cost more to borrow. So that is the cost that has already come from this decision. I mean, essentially, it's a very simple story. Jacob Zuma has friends who are called the Guptas. They are an Indian family, arrived around the time that apartheid was being abolished in 1994. And they really have funded him and backed him. He's backed them. But someone like Pravin Gordhan, who is a very upright man, said that some of their dealings were wrong, that there was millions of rand that had been unaccounted for in the way that deals were done, and he made sure the banks closed down their accounts. Now, they've moved a lot of their accounts to a lot of their assets to the Gulf, but nonetheless, they have a lot of influence in South Africa. And quite frankly, Mr. Zuma is now acting in their interests. And it's interesting that their radio station, their television station, AAN7, was the one that broke the story of Gordon being sacked. There are also two other issues, which is all to do with money. It looks as if the South Africans are now going to sign a massive deal with the Russians for nuclear power stations. Everyone suggests this is not good, well invested, that this is going to cost them an arm and a leg more than South Africa can afford, and all has to do with kickbacks. And the second thing they're doing is that, frankly, the Treasury is now at the disposal of Mr. Gupta, of the Gupta family, and Mr. Zuma, and they're going to help themselves. And that was what Pravin Gordhan was standing in the way of. Him gone, and frankly, the coffers are now at his disposal, and this is an absolute disaster for South Africa.
Tom, a terrible, terrible story. And what's so awful about it is, you know, this is a very rich country in mineral resources, in exports. It has so much going
potential,
for it.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, since the fall of apartheid, many have felt that South Africa could be an absolute beacon of how to run a successful African nation. It looks a terrible failure, doesn't it?
Well, again, look however you want to look at it. Growth rate, not 0.5%. Unemployment, 27% right now. And those numbers are stagnant. They're not getting any better. As far as some of these large investment projects, I'm not familiar with the background on how you pay for these things, what the government coffers look like right now. But again, you're kind of locking yourself away for, I guess, decades on repayments on some of these things. I guess it raises the question, will there be a vote of no confidence in the not-too-distant future? What would be the potential likelihood of that being successful or not? I'm not sure. But it is troubling right now because you say the potential has always been there, not realized.
Martin, what are the opportunities to do something to stop Mr. Zuma? So we're seeing street protests. We're seeing many people who are in government and civil society saying this is a terrible thing, that something needs to be done. But what is the thing that can be done?
Well, the key test will come in Parliament. Chair of Parliament flew back from the East, where she was away, and she is now examining. There are two votes of no confidence have already been put by the opposition parties. This will be heard in about a week's time. The question is whether enough ANC MPs will come over to the opposition to support them. It's not clear that that will happen, but it's possible. It depends on the balance of forces within the ANC, and we just can't know at this stage. But there's one other thing that one must remember, which is that Jacob Zuma was the head of Umkhonto Sizwe, the ANC's armed wing's intelligence. It was called Mkhondo, and it's the stone that crushes. He knows where all the bodies are buried inside the ANC. He's their intelligence man from way back, and he put a lot of his people into the current intelligence and secret services. One of the tools they used against Pravin Gordhan was a so-called intelligence report saying that he was plotting while in London to overthrow Jacob Zuma. That's effectively what the charge they made against him. It was, I think, in my view, utter nonsense. But the other thing that's happened is that the Gupta family have the services of Bell Pottinger, the British public relations firm, and they have been also using their, shall we say, dark arts to spread stories and make allegations against anyone who stands up to Jacob Zuma or the Guptas. So it's a very, very dark story, I'm afraid.
And Martin, you'd hope that, you know, you'd imagine that a change in circumstances with the economy might be the pressure to force things to change. But we only have to look across the border at Zimbabwe, what's happened for generations there, that actually you can have an economy on its knees and still a leader can cling to power.
Absolutely. And Jacob Zuma will do exactly what Robert Mugabe has done. He said, look, I'm now going to we're going to seize the white land, white-owned farms. We're going to seize white businesses and we're going to redistribute them to black people. And this is a wonderful new dawn that I'm going to open up for people. I think that's what he'll offer. And I cannot predict, I don't think anybody can, which way it's going to go.
Well, finally on today's show, it's time to have a look at Budapest. Yesterday, thousands of people marched through the city in support of the Central European University. The university, founded by Hungarian-born billionaire George Soros in 1991, claims it is being directly targeted by draft legislation submitted by Prime Minister Viktor Orban's government last week, which would see it banned from awarding Hungarian diplomas. Tom, George Soros, we love him or not.
We love him or hate him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, he's the university seems to be a good thing. It's in the top 200 universities in the world for several disciplines. It's widely popular. It's probably one of the best universities in Central Europe. But Viktor Orban doesn't like him and therefore doesn't like it.
Doesn't like him, doesn't like his brand of globalization, doesn't like the influence of some NGOs as well. So we're seeing his particular brand of populism in control right now and doing what he will. I think the word he's using right now is national security considerations, in his view, to close down the university. But again, he's in the driver's seat right now.
Martin, Viktor Orban is another one of these people that you know you hope someone would be able to stand up to. The European Union has tried on several occasions, but he's you know, a mercurial character who seems to be able to make friends both east and west, so he can knock on the door of Moscow.
Absolutely.
So is he another person that you think it's very hard over this issue to kind of curtail?
Absolutely, and he's the sort of man who sort of surfs the mood of the nation. And you know, if the nation is feeling it's on the you know more conservative, then he will go that. I mean, he describes his position now as illiberal liberalism, whatever that means. Perhaps Tom can fill us in.
I know, I love it, but exactly an easy definition, right?
But I mean, it's the same as the polls. The polls have moved in a similar direction. This is the tide of history at the moment, and it's hard to stop.
And it's interesting when you look at all those Eastern countries. You know, again, when they came into the Western fold of the world, when they joined the EU, there was a feeling that these were places that could be really kind of outposts of democracy, especially somewhere like Hungary, where you'd had the uprising in Budapest during the times of communism. You knew that there was this groundswell of people who really wanted to kind of go back to being, you know, a democratic European country. Why do you think it hasn't worked, do you think, Tom?
I don't know why it hasn't, but you think back, those are halcyon days, the early 90s, covering that in some of the places, seeing the incredible change, the emotions, the flavor of the day. And I guess it's taken a while for the pendulum to swing back, those that haven't felt the touch of prosperity, perhaps. And things are, you know, we'll swing in that direction for a while, and it's very unique, different times. We're seeing the phenomenon. We saw it in the Netherlands. We're going to see it in France. We're going to see it in Germany. So we'll see exactly how it plays out in Hungary.
Martin, it's been the same in Poland. You know, a step to a more populist kind of politics, and perhaps all down that strip of former Iron Curtain nations. There is a tendency, again, we're talking about these shifts to a former time at the beginning of the show. There is a sense that people don't quite like the European experiment in the way that they thought they would.
And I think beneath that is the economic crisis that we've been through. It has been a very, very severe. It was very interesting that the governor of the central bank, the British central bank, the Bank of England, recently pointed out that the recession was the worst since 1860. Now, it's not something that people have actually picked up, but actually it has been very severe. The crisis is tough, and the results are that ordinary people are feeling their position worse than their parents. And almost always people think, at least we'll hand on something better to our children. And now they're not able to say that. And that produces very severe reactions.
Well, we haven't exactly been able to leave you with a spring in your step at the end of the show.
Afraid not.
Today.
Sorry, guys.
But that is all we have time for. My thanks to Tom Rivers and Martin Plaut for joining me here today on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Carlos Rabello and is researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Alexis Sogol. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Robert Bound. We're going to have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours, where we'll also be covering the bomb attacks in St. Petersburg. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.